Meeting will come to order. Quorum. Representative Olem, would you move the minutes?
Yes, I'll move the minutes. Of March 23rd.
Representative Olem, move the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The minutes are approved and we have a quorum. Representative Leader.
Madam Chair, I would move the division report from Veteran Affairs Division on House File 980.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Madam Chair, I move House File 980, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. Madam Chair, members, House File 980 deals with the help modifying the eligibility for to take the peace officer's reciprocity training exam. It's what the bill does, it kind of modifies it to make it probably to improve the eligibility for people that have in the military that were in basically the military police and that had law enforcement training. The existing law, the old statute said you had to have 5 years, and what this does, it actually modifies it a little bit because most enlistments now are 4 years, and that's created a little bit of a problem. But all this does is it allows the eligible veteran to apply and take the exam. It doesn't mean they're passing it or putting it in. But so really, where we had 5 years in present statute, what this does is modifies it for 3 years of military service plus combined with a post-secondary law enforcement degree, or else a 5-year experience from a full-time peace officer in another state. And it also modifies the provisions, but you can have 3 years of qualified military service and with some a military MOS in the military police or training in an academy, in the military academy, and that basically would qualify them to apply to take the peace officer exam. Right now there's a problem with getting enough people to apply or even take the exam. And the bill was put together pretty much with the post board, the peace officers training board, and the state patrol in cooperation, I think, with all the law enforcement groups. And Madam Chair, a testifier from the state patrol would qualify the statement.
Okay, say your name for the state, please.
Madam Chair, Michelle Tuckner with the State Patrol. As Representative Leader pointed out, our purpose of this bill today, it is the agency initiative, is to address that issue of right now it currently states 5 years enlistment period. Most enlistment periods are 4 years. We've crafted some language in conjunction with the Post Board, and it is supported by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association as well. And I think Representative Leader spoke to the details of that. It would be 3 years of a military law enforcement specialty combined with a 2-year post-year degree, or a combination of 5 years, either law enforcement, a peace officer in another state, combined with that military service as well. The intent is to broaden the pool for law enforcement candidates and to give those military folks some more opportunities for jobs as well.
Anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I'm clear on this, is it a combination of both, or could the individual be serving 5 years in the National Guard alone and qualify as well? Would it have to be a combination of serving in both?
Madam Chair, as long as the service is in a military police service specialty, 5 years enlistment is acceptable.
Any other questions? If not,
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, it appears that we have the wrong copy of the bill in the folders. We should have the first committee engrossment. So we can get some copies of that unless it's, I guess I wasn't in the Veterans Affairs Commission division. Maybe Mr. Cleary can explain the differences.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, the bill was amended in the division, and I no longer have the wrong copy in front of me, but basically on two lines, if I may, on line 111, the word successful graduation from the Military Service Law Enforcement Academy, comma, and was deleted. So that line 111 would just say, number one, 5 years active service experience, and so on. And then on line 113, the same change was made. Successful graduation from a Military Service Law Enforcement Academy, comma, was deleted. That was the principal change made, and then the title, of course, was conformed to that. So we would be acting, properly we should be acting upon the first committee engrossment here rather than the as introduced bill. All the testimony and the bill summary are accurate to the first committee engrossment.
Madam Chair, do any of the committee members require a copy of the first committee engrossment? We have the motion, correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Leary, is that the only changes that were made?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, they're the only ones that I can remember. I believe they were the only ones.
Madam Chair, perhaps Madam Chair, Representative, maybe we could just lay this over for a moment. We get a copy. Going to the general register, we can still act on it yet today. We can just lay it over, have a page, get us a copy of the engrossed, the first committee engrossment, so we can be sure that's what we're voting on. So that's my motion, to lay it over until we can get it. I don't just lay it over, lay it on the table, whichever one's the appropriate one.
House file 980 will be laid on the table until we get another bill.
I appreciate you defending it for me.
So, Madam Chair, my understanding is that what we'll do is we're going to get a copy of the first committee engrossment. All members of the committee will be able to read the engrossment, just make sure there were no other changes beyond what Mr. Cleary described, and at that point we can then vote on that bill. So maybe we can move to House File 1880 until we get a copy of that engrossment, if that's agreeable, Madam Chair. Okay. Well, then, Madam Chair, I would...
Representative Leader?
Madam Chair, would you want me to return? Is that what you're saying? Basically, what Mr. Cleary said, and I thought Representative Severson was on the committee. That was his change, and I see Mr. Sterner, is that correct? He was on the committee. So they're aware of what the three of the members are in here that were in the change, and that was a small change that Mr. Cleary talked about, and that's the only change in it, in the first engrossment. Yeah. But if you want me to come back, I'd appreciate it, but I'd like to know when I should come back.
Madam Chair, I'm comfortable on voting now. I just want to make sure that everyone on the committee is comfortable before we move forward, since we didn't have the first committee engrossment. We do have members who were there present for the amendments that were made to the copy that was in front of us.
Madam Chair, you know, I just wanted to make sure we know what we're voting on. This is going right to the floor. You know, that's the only thing. I don't think there's any issue here whatsoever. Just, I think it's responsible to know what, reading through and know what we're voting on.
Madam Chair, I would tend to agree with Representative Hamilton. It's not going to take us a long time to get the first meeting engrossment. We do have to have bills.
Madam Chair,
I don't know that Representative Leader needs to stay here for this.
Madam Chair, I have a copy of the first meeting engrossment. I've printed offline.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Dostkowski and I both looked at the first committee engrossment, and it does conform to the changes that Mr. Cleary told us, the deletions regarding successful graduation on both lines 1.11 and 1.13. So, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 980, the first committee engrossment, first be taken from the table.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
And then I would renew my motion that House File 980, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, moving to the next House file, I would move the Division Report from Veteran Affairs Division on House File 1880.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1880, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. And then, Madam Chair, I have one more motion. I have talked with the author. I would move the A2 amendment for House File 1880 to get it in the shape that the author wants it.
Any questions on the amendment? If not, we'll proceed. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Thanks for the opportunity today to bring House File 1880 before you. I do have an author's amendment to the amendment, if I could just submit that to the body at this point. On lines 1.6 on the amendment, after the word service, strike as defined in section 190.05, subdivision 5B and 5C. So it would be strike that provision, and one other amendment on line 1.15. It says procedures described in section 197.46 to 197.48 after the 8 add a 1. So it would be 147.481, and the same amendment to line 117, 147.481. And the clarification, this amendment to the amendment does some clarification of the language. It narrows down the scope of the definition of veteran, so it makes it a little more concise. And then the amendment on line 1.15 and 1.17 expands. It doesn't expand it, but it gives a little more clarification on the statute that is being addressed here.
Mr. Cleary, do you have the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. I would just add to what Representative Severson said, just a little bit of detail. The amendment also, the middle part, beginning on line 111, stipulates that the veteran has an irrevocable choice of either to use the veteran's preference hearing in a dismissal case or rely upon the grievance process under the current contract. And then the third part of the amendment simply stipulates that the data collection would go prospective, going forward only, rather than retrospectively. So the amendment does those three things. Representative Severson had also mentioned the very first thing was to narrow the scope of the veterans to whom it applies. Narrow them to recent returning veterans, those who had served since 9/11.
Does everybody understand the amendment?
Madam Chair, I will move the amendments on lines 1.16, 1.17, that 1.15, and 1.17 that Representative Severson described.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And to the bill, let me just kind of lay some groundwork here. 1975, shortly after the Vietnam War was over, we had members who were returning home. And even during that process previous to that, we had members who were returning home from an unpopular war. There was a general sentiment that, you know, we were associating our soldiers with the mission that was over there, and many of them came home to a hostile environment. Consequently, I think what happened in 1975 with the veterans' preference, some of the bite was, or some of the adherence to that veterans' preference that previously existed was taken out. And consequently, what happened is we had a lot of veterans who were returning home to a hostile environment and finding it difficult to make the transition from life and death situations into a society that asked them to go overseas. And when they returned, were less than appreciative of the service that they had rendered while over there. So, you know, given that scenario, many of those individuals came back to try and get a job, and because this particular veteran's preference had been removed, or a lot of the bite had been taken out of it, were not able to find a job. Now we fast forward to today, and some of the implications of that policy are that we have a disproportionate number of veterans, and I'm not going to say a huge number, but we have some people who I believe should not have fallen under that duress and who are now living in some of our rehabilitation facilities, living under bridges, and are finding it hard to cope. And I will submit to you that I think a lot of that was because we did not support them when they came back. And what you'll find is the Vietnam veterans' motto is never again. Never again will that happen, the same thing that happened to us that happened to our soldiers when we came back. And this is a small measure to try and bring some of that lessons learned to today. In our veterans' preference, this is a provision that basically says if there is an individual who is being released from active duty, and this would go for both Guard and Reserve and our active duty members, that when they go to apply for a state or local job, that they at least, and they meet the minimum qualifications, they at least have the opportunity to have an interview. We aren't saying that if they meet minimum qualifications that they are automatically going to be hired, but they at least get the opportunity to go before an interviewer and plead their case. That's the first portion. The second portion is, as a result of some of the onerous positions, and I will say because of the force of the previous veterans' preference, there was a scapegoat that was put in into a statute that basically says, if you get the job, then we're going to hire you, and then we're going to meet our quota, and then we're going to fire you. So as a consequence, on the backside, they put in this provision that basically says, if you get fired, you have a veteran's response to a hearing, writ of mandamus, basically, that proves that your firing is justified. So it's kind of a crunch section there, which once the veteran's preference came off, now it kind of leaves employers with the attitude that, look, it's so hard to fire them, why hire them in the first place? Now we don't have any mandate to hire them, but it's more difficult to get rid of a veteran than another individual, so why would we hire them in the first place? But this goes back to this, and this no longer makes both of them available. It says the veteran has either the opportunity for writ of mandamus or relief under the grievance process of the Civil Service Act. Okay, so we make it either or. So we say that they can't use both, they can use either or. And then the last portion of the bill goes to a study that was done for the department to determine how many veterans are currently serving in our executive branch and in our government at large, and to determine if those numbers are high or low. And I think that there's some conflicting considerations on this. Bottom line is our numbers are reduced, are being reduced. They are going down as the amount of veterans that are currently serving in the state capacity in jobs. Okay, so we've got a couple testifiers that have come forward here, but I just want to kind of close the loop here by saying this bill merely allows the individual veterans who are post 9/11, post September 11, 2001, who have served from that time until now to be available to have an interview, to at least get guaranteed an interview. And the argument here being is when we under Soldiers Civil Relief Act mandate that private enterprise, that those people that are going over there, they're taking a year out of their life and sometimes more to go over and defend our country on a volunteer basis, they come back, they're having problems integrating, and we're asking the private sector under Soldiers Civil Relief Act to step up to the plate and give these guys their job back. We as a state ought to be leading the way by saying, you know what, if you can't find a job, then we are going to give you some preference for a state job. Currently, we don't do that. And that's what this bill is aimed at fixing. And I'll make some closing comments, Madam Chair, but I think there are a couple testifiers that were here on both sides. I might also add, I appreciate you hearing the bill on such a short notice. I know we had it last Friday in the Veterans Committee, and we had some considerable disagreement on some of those issues. We've met several times, and we've come to a consensus with Minnesota Management and Budget and with the Veterans Administration, and I think we've ironed this thing out, so we've got a good product here. And I won't say that, it was easy, but there were compromises on all sides, and I think we've got, for that process, it went well. So, Madam Chair, perhaps we could hear from witnesses at this time.
Madam Chair, members, Mike Police, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to lend the department support, thank Representative Severson for bringing it forward and his willingness to work with us in compromise. We think it's a good bill. We think, we know we'd like to see a lot more veterans working in state employment. And I think this is going to help us get there. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Severson, one of the things that I've been hearing from folks in state government is questions about the number of veterans in some of the upper-level administrative positions within agencies. I really like the bill. The reporting section, does it give us the ability to discern those veterans, say 5 or 10 years down the road, who have been hired into as a proportion of their representation, have been hired into some of the management positions within some of our state and local organizations?
Madam Chair and Representative Gretkowski, the goal on the reporting here is just to get a feel of how many veterans are actually applying for the job and how many are actually hired and what the trends are in terms of veterans serving in state employment. It would not give us a reflection of those who are moving into management positions or any upper level echelon. That would be a separate issue.
Are there any other questions? If not.
Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1880 as amended, the First Committee of Engrossment, or the First Committee of Engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and committee members, appreciate it.
Representative
Khan. Madam Chair, as Representative Khan's coming to the table, I would move House File 608 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Oversight.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I do have a little bit of show and tell. I didn't quite dare. It turns out industrial hemp flower is not available in Mark Stockinson. These are miniature chocolate truffles and they're sprinkled with industrial hemp seeds. Is that sort of I will say an example of what we could do. I had originally, Madam Chairman, if I can, this bill was originally scheduled for Monday, which actually was my birthday. And so what I was doing was I was making this as an easy-to-eat piece of birthday cake for things. And then when it was switched, I just decided I would do it anyway. It's true there isn't a large amount of the of it, as so those little seeds on top are commercially available industrial hemp seeds, and the and I will say considering the amount of chocolate, butter, and cream that's in it, it is the most healthy part of the cookie, cake, whatever it is. Anyway, yes. Also, as part of the sell and tell, I will point out these are both bought from the Wedge Co-op, Natural Foods Co-op. This is Manitoba Harvest shelled hemp seeds, and I will pass it around. This little package of 8 ounces costs $8.95. Fortunately, I had my credit card with me. This, I don't know if it was grown in Minnesota or not, but it's on the same kind of acreage, and so these are sunflower seeds, roasted sunflower seeds. I imagine they're probably the high value part of a sunflower crop, and the cost of the same volume of sunflower seeds was about $1.30. So we're looking at a very significant value added. Think of some easy way to taste them. You can spill them out and taste them. And Madam Chairman, I also have an amendment to House File 608, which I think should make it much more palatable.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Any questions? I'll just say what the A1 amendment does is this means that we don't move ahead of state, or we don't even move even with states like North Dakota. We really do not put the bill into effect until the Drug Enforcement Administration has authorized the growing of industrial hemp in the United States. So I think it's a really stepping back a step to make sure that we'll continue to let North Dakota lead us on this issue. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Madam Chairman, Tom Peterson is coming down. Let me just briefly go through the bill summary, and you see that sections 1 to 16, so we're not inventing new wheels here, it directs the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to regulate industrial hemp in the same way in which it currently regulates plants and nursery stock. In the 17 clarifies that a person charged with a violation by the MDA may also be charged with a controlled substance violation, so we're not in competition with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The new chapter is chapter 18, and it states that the new chapter may be referred to as the Industrial Hemp Development Act. We then lay out the legislative purpose and put in do the definitions, authorize it as an agricultural crop. I'll point out that nothing really happens until we get to Section 24, which is the rulemaking activity of the MDA. So nothing of the previous statements can happen until that happens. And the amendment that we just added is
says that we don't do that until the DEA has really authorized it to be gone. I'll briefly go through and then I'll turn to Tom Peterson, my strong supporter from the Farmers Union. And I'll say the Farm Bureau, Minnesota Farm Bureau, has also taken a position in favor of this, but National Farm Bureau has not. They're not in opposition anymore. At one point, they were in opposition. They're now neutral on it, and the local one does. I'll just point out the things that you have in your packet. First thing is my a person whom I wish I could, in fact, I wish I were him. If I was him, it would be much easier, I think. This is Representative David Monson, whom I've talked to for years, who's the Republican Speaker of the House in North Dakota. And he's the one who's taken the lead on this issue in the country. And so you see some two things from him under his letterhead. One is a letter in support of why we should go ahead and how often North Dakota, in fact, has passed this bill, that this is now part of the North Dakota Code. Behind that, it's a really useful pamphlet. You can pull it out and make it a threefold the way it's supposed to, which came from Representative Monson, which, again, summarized probably a lot of the stuff that both Tom is going to tell you and that we have in the other materials. Next, you have someone who came to testify the last time I had this bill is a Professor Weibland, who is still is unfortunately on sabbatical this year and pretty unreachable. And this article from the University of Minnesota Daily talks about his research, which is really developing a totally drug-free industrial hemp plant. So that we're really, so that if that becomes the standard, we'll really be away from any kinds of quantification and looking at meetings and so forth. There's also, they can also using genetic markers, they can also totally identify the two plants. The next one, again, from a few years ago, I guess I didn't keep the time of it, is the article from the New York Times talking about how hemp is a $50 million industry and also pointing out it's an environmentally friendly crop. And I'd now like to turn to someone you're very familiar with to speak on the subject.
State your name for the case, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Farmers Union, and I'm here today to express our support, strong support for this legislation. This is really a good letter, by the way, that if you've read it from David Monson and all the research I've done on and talking to farmers about it. He lays out several of my points in there. I just highlight a few of them. Appreciate the over 20 co-sponsors, bipartisan co-sponsors we have for this legislation. I've been interested in this since 1997 when Canada took a more positive step on this. And actually was farming then and attended a farm meeting in Grafton at the co-op with the legislators there, and they were split on the issue, but the farmers weren't. All the farmers there were very united in saying, you know, we should look at this as an option. And this is clearly just what it is. This it would be an option, another option for farmers. The old-time farmers, even in some of our meetings sometimes, will remember in the 40s when they grew hemp, and that was strongly encouraged, and it was something we relied on for all kinds of products. It's good to see the hemp food passed out. The hemp food business is growing very quickly in Minnesota. 28 states have hemp legislation introduced, 15 have acted on it, and 8 have removed barriers that have passed it, similar to North Dakota. And I think that's real positive. There's many products, of course, you can make from it. It's interesting when we work on this legislation, I've gotten many calls from around the country. This isn't a piece I spend a lot of time on, but I've gotten a lot of calls from a professor in Iowa, for example, is working on biodiesel and looking at that. Interestingly enough, hemp biodiesel is green in color. But there are some barriers to be working on. Just some other facts or ideas. The best I could find was in In Canada, for example, in 2005, they planted 24,000 acres of hemp, industrial hemp. In 2006, they planted 50,000 acres of industrial hemp. So not a lot of acreage, but a significant amount. And again, it's a good option. It provides, as this letter says, as the farmers I've talked to have used it, it's a valuable rotational crop, the ideal for up in northwestern Minnesota and Representative Olin, Eakin District, and even in east central Minnesota. Because of scab and blights, and especially in potatoes, it's a good crop to rotate in. The estimates are anywhere from $300 to $600 an acre. A farmer I talked to recently in Canada told me it's more on the $300 an acre end. But he said the good thing is, unlike corn and soybeans, it doesn't attract pests, you don't need herbicides, and so the input costs are much lower. And so that's been real positive. Just for your information, it's grown from seed. It's an annual crop. It's planted in early spring when the soil gets warm, reaches 10 to 12 feet after about 75 to 90 days. It's uses normal hay equipment to harvest with some modifications. It's cut, and then it's laid on the ground. They use what's called a redding process. I've never seen it, but I've watched several videos on it, where the leaves fall off and go back into the soil for organic matter, which is a real positive thing. And then it's turned over with a rake, let it dry a little bit more, and then baled, and either goes to the processing plant or farmers hold it and sell it at appropriate times. And so it's just a lot of options. It's an option we'd like you to consider. I appreciate the amendment. This letter also says Representative Monson in North Dakota, he's worked with the Ag Commissioner in North Dakota, who last week became our president of National Farmers Union, Roger Johnson. And so he has indicated to me he'll be working at the federal level on this too. So appreciate your time and thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First of all, historically, hemp was used a lot in World War II era. I could you come to visit me by Grove City, I can take you to the site of the hemp plant. It is now a turkey barn, but it was a hemp plant in World War II. But just a few questions. Mr. Peterson, or Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson, this is the leaf is not used, is that it's the stalk that's used, is that right?
Madam Chair, the stalk is used, or the seed as you've seen too, but the stalk is it's the durable, the fiber and everything in the stock, as I understand it. Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Follow up? Thank you. When it's baled, this isn't used as animal feed, is it? I mean, did dairy cattle eat this?
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's used as feed. I saw it today when I was looking too that they use it for a high grade bedding for some of it. I know the seed breaks down really fast and it depends, so I'm not sure on how that's harvested. I haven't seen where it's been used as feed, but I know it's used for many, many products. I think they say 25,000 products. I haven't seen actual feed, but I have seen where it's used as animal bedding after part of the process where they take the strands out or whatever. So.
And one more point, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Kahn, in the fold-out, as we have noted earlier, the Drug Enforcement Agency policy makes industrial hemp illegal, but then two states, North Dakota and Vermont, have legalized hemp, so they are doing that. How does that work then, in defiance of the Drug Enforcement Agency, or how do they work that out with them?
Again, if you read Mr. Monson's letter, he keeps trying to get a license, and he can't get it. So I gather he's not, and I don't know what's happening in Vermont, but I gather he's not growing it until he gets the license from,
okay.
I mean, this guy's a Republican, he's Speaker of the House. Probably doesn't want to get arrested. So he's not growing it, I believe, until he gets the license from the DEA. And we've even gone before it, behind him. We said we don't even start our rulemaking process, which then puts everything else into place until the DEA has issued a permit to be able to do it.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. Number one, on the federal level, it kind of goes to what Representative Rudolph was asking about. Do you have any reason to believe that the U.S. government is going to start issuing license anytime soon, or which yes. makes this all worthwhile, or are we just, you know...
I imagine, Madam Chairman and Representative Faust, I imagine it's not, with all the other stuff that's going on and our problems, it's not highest on their priority. But the new head of DEA is the former police chief of Seattle, who had a very progressive policy towards minimal drug enforcement. So I'm quite, I don't know when it's going to happen, and that's why this bill is posed to take effect only after it happens, so that we don't spend money and we don't do rules until then.
Okay. Second question, thank you, Madam Chair. Second question is that, you know, this whole industry hasn't been in existence for 40 or 50 years. How long is it going to take before the market and the infrastructure gets in place so that there's actually a market for the farmers if they would start growing it? If, you know, next year, for example, we could start getting the license from the federal government, how long is it going to be before, you know, everything is in place so that we can actually start growing a mass amount of it?
I will point out we're the only industrialized country that doesn't allow hemp to be grown, so that there are models behind that. And let me turn to the more informed person.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Paulus, that's a good question. I think that just like as we're looking at biomass, I serve on the governor's DexGen Energy Board, we're looking at all kinds of different things that, you know, the market hopefully would come. As we said, the odd thing about this is it's the one product, we can buy it here, but they grow it in Canada. We can't grow it here. We can grow it anywhere in the world, but in the United States, we can buy all the products here. And some of them are, you know, so we can get the manufacturing and talk about green jobs. I got a call from a guy who's working on a program for hempcrete because concrete is a huge emitter of carbon. And so they're looking in Europe and in southern parts of the state of this can get going too, but they're moving towards making concrete out of hemp, for example. And so there's just all kinds of things. And by the way, it has a really low emission of carbon, stores and sequesters carbon. So there's all kinds of things with its fuels. Food, I looked in Canada, I think they, I forget what percent, maybe 50% of all the hemp that is used for some kind of food, or it's turned into some kind of food product. And so hopefully, the farmer I talked to, too, he did tell me that the one thing they've learned about is transport is important, so that they're looking at trying to locate the facilities close to the farmers, because we're not going to grow hemp, you know, say in Representative Shemansky's district, in your district, and Representative Olin's district. They're going to probably try to put the plant or wherever the processing place somewhere, and then contract with the growers in the area near that, so that their transportation costs are not high. So I'd be optimistic about it. But
Madam Chairman, if I can just add another comment. Representative Monson's district is right up against the Canadian border, and apparently he got interested in this when they were hit with very heavy, I think it was barley scab, was several years ago, and he was looking just across the border at his neighbor who was had totally switched to industrial hemp, and as he was getting essentially nothing for his crop, I don't remember what the amount was that year, this guy was getting, was on, you know, literally the same land was making a sizable, I don't know if farmers ever make a sizable profit, but was, at least let me say, was doing significantly better than he was.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably a couple of different series of questions, but first of all, to either Representative Kahn or Mr. Peterson, is the federal regulation, is industrial hemp considered a national crop, a national concern, or is it more of a regional product that we would be looking at?
Well, it's very good to hear. It's been good in places like Kentucky. Trump
would
probably do a better answer
than
me on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Shemansky, I don't know that for sure, you know, exactly what they're you know, or what they're looking at, or how. I just know that the farmers that, you know, remember growing here said it grew well, you know, and it was a good product, and it just, back to my comments, that it makes sense to the what they're learning in Canada, because again, it started in 97, and I think it was like 2001 before they really got going on it, was that it looked at like better at doing regional. At first they had the hemp growing was kind of spread out, and they did have some stockpiles and problems transporting it. Now they're moving more to a regional system, like I was saying, where they're going to contract with farmers, you know, in certain areas to grow it and then process it from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was grown in my district heavily during World War II. In fact, the site of the present Minnesota mining plant in Hutchinson was originally a hemp plant. It's been known, you know, over the years as, you know, the locally they call it ditch weed now. Yeah. It's, you know, you just don't eradicate those kind of things. But the concern I have is that, is this intended, if we, let's say, were to develop a national policy for hemp, would it be displacing some other commodities grown in this country, like cotton or, you know, some other fibers?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, I don't think so. And again, I think this is, like I said, it's an option. This is not going to be a huge deal. Like it's in all of Canada, it's like 24,000 acres, which sounds like a lot, but it's really not a huge amount of acreage. What it does is, like I said earlier, is it works good as a rotational crop that they've found in Canada, where they've had some really bad, as they said, barley scab. They've had some rust, some kind of acid. Anyways, it's a good thing to rotate into the crop, to be technical, into that. And so that helps, you know, anytime you can provide it. And also for income, like I said, if on the high side, they've been getting $600 an acre. You know, if you do the simple math on $2 or $3 corn, a cash price on corn is like $3.50 right now, and then you factor in the inputs, or, you know, $9, $10 soybeans, or $5 wheat up in those areas, and then factor in the inputs. You know, if you can get up to $500-$600 an acre, you know, that's a good price. But it's, again, you know, the markets are not going to be huge, but it'll be simply an option for, which also will help, you know, the other prices and the bottom line for the farmer. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I was just wondering if we had a member from the Department of Agriculture just say if they support this, and then talk about the implementation and cost in the event this would pass. We could. And on that note, while they're coming up, testify, Representative Kahn, just for my own curiosity, how do they tell? Can you tell, aside from testing, what the THC level would be in hemp if it's grown out in a field for law enforcement? And does law enforcement support this?
Law enforcement is here, and they do not support this. And they are worried about the need to quantify the amount below that. But the one point I want to make it absolutely clear is that there's no problem telling the visually telling which is which, because one is a plant that grows 7 or 8 feet tall, and the other one is a short bushy plant concentrated with a big leafy development. It's interesting too, because we haven't heard it. Sometimes we've heard this sense, well, people are going to I really liked it the year I had my geneticist here, but people are going to hide the high-tech stuff by growing it in the other stuff. And the answer is, genetically, that doesn't work, because they both cross-pollinate and ruin each other. And so the other, so you can, and, you know, my answer to law enforcement, if they're spending any time taking something that looks like going to the point of measuring the THC level, you know, they probably ought to be doing something else. If they don't have something that they know comes from a source which is very likely to be a commercial source of marijuana, it's probably not worth going after the kids who picked up some ditch weed and he's trying to get himself sick. I understand that to smoke about an acre before before you get that. So and again, it's very likely the geneticist working at the U of M, that's not here this year, is working on a really simple DNA test to just completely distinguish the two kinds, and to get an industrial hemp variety and that could be the kind that was licensed then, that would have absolutely no THC. So,
thank you.
Say your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Quinn Teen, Policy Director for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I believe, Representative Hamilton, you asked me to comment on implementation of this and also on the cost. And I was very grateful to see the amendment that Representative Kahn offered, which would, I was a little bit concerned about how we would develop the regulations and the licensing program and the cost that would be involved there. So I was glad that we don't now have to do that until after the U.S. Department of Justice authorizes the growing of hemp, industrial hemp. That said, I am a little bit concerned just that the possibility, should it move quickly, should the U.S. Department of Justice move quickly, then there is no there's no startup cost for a program like this. And so I don't know how quickly we would be able to develop that. I don't think a fiscal note has been requested on it. So I know we are able to collect fees, but we'd have to start collecting the fees, so we'd have to have a program in order to collect the fees. Just a concern that we can work out as it moves forward. But
Madam Chair, if I could just also point out, someone asked about hemp just displacing cotton. My expert of hemp as a fabric is actually the chair of the committee and has all kinds of good knowledge of that.
Right. I'm a textile geek, so I really like hemp fabric, quite frankly. It's very, they're very strong garments, hardly ever have problems with anything with those. But that's my going fishing thing, is to do textiles, and it's a lot of fun to use hemp because it's so easy to use. Representative Erdahl. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just got a question. It's still bothering me. First off, you got to understand, I'm a 32-year prosecutor. Second off, you got to understand that in my district, up in the Roseau County area, not too many years ago, we had probably the largest field of marijuana growing in history in this state that was prosecuted, that they hid. And I, mind you, I said hid because they did, that they got caught with. So I'm still not totally convinced how a peace officer, and this does not mean I'm necessarily going to vote against this, but how a peace officer is supposed to look at that little layer circle around the edge of the field and know if there's marijuana in there when they've already got a history in that area of people doing that.
Madam Chairman and Representative, there's nothing in the, first of all, if you were going to illegally grow, do anything, the last thing I think you would do is go to the Department of Agriculture, go through the licensing and regulation process and inspection process that's listed in this bill. And, you know, imagine whatever they were hiding it in, they weren't hiding it with, they weren't using industrial hemp to hide it, wherever they were hiding it. And it's one of the things I think my geneticist said the last time he was, Dr. Redlin said the last time he was here, was if you really wanted to stop all of the outside growing of the drug hemp, you would encourage everybody to plant huge fields of the industrial hemp, because it would completely ruin that crop. So it could be a tremendous preventive item.
From a comfort area, and it'll probably come up again at a later time.
I think you guys need another set of
No. And you won't catch me eating one of those either, by the way. But from a comfort area, all I'm going to say on this issue, and I, like I said, I don't even know how I'm going to vote. I really would love to have heard the Genesis explain this to me, because I have some real concerns about that issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I'm getting a little nervous because I heard a lot about bounties in college, you know,
yeah,
and whatnot.
No. This is on the same seeds that have the same, the only thing on that is the same seeds that have that package which was bought legally in Minneapolis.
And Madam Chair, she's pushing them awful hard as well.
Well.
Most of this bill. So. I'm just teasing Representative Kahn. I mean no disrespect.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kahn, is that vote coercion?
No, not at all.
I would just offer, yesterday, Representative Kahn, on a more serious note, we were in the Public Safety Committee, and they were talking about medicinal marijuana. And some of the cultivars that they had there were approaching 10 feet tall or more. So that's a different type of plant than you were describing in terms of the marijuana plants, and they had a variety of pictures. They're very tall, robust plants. They had a picture of a tall man next to him, and it was 3 or 4 feet over his head. So I don't know that matches. At least those were the marijuana cultivars that they were looking at using for medicinal purposes.
I have not paid attention to that, and I thought that was not true, that we didn't get good production except from the sort which he was, but I'm not an expert.
Representative House?
I guess I have more of a comment than a question. I think that this is a good idea. I think it's time that we do this, and you know, the sky isn't going to fall down tomorrow because the federal government has to approve it, and so I think that this is a good idea to finally get this moving, and so I'd urge everyone to support it.
Okay. Are there any other testifiers? As he's getting sitting down, I just want to say that I do not smoke my fabric.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Frank Dolich. That's spelled D-O-L-E-J-S-I. I'm the lab director at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm not here to be either opposed or to support this legislation. I'm just here to comment on what I would describe as maybe an unintended consequence of this bill that changes the definition of marijuana. And if you look on page 8, line .824 to .825, so now you're changing the definition under the Controlled Substances Act. It says that marijuana does not include industrial hemp as defined in Section 18K03. And the outcome of that is that this changes the definition in such a way that for the identification of marijuana in the future, if this bill passes, that all samples of marijuana, if they're going to be contested, would have to go to a laboratory. That laboratory will have to test that sample to see whether it's either under 0.3% THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, or over it. And that will be a significant cost to laboratories, and although we haven't been asked to provide a fiscal note from the House, we have been asked to provide a fiscal note on the Senate counterpart, and that's in the process of being developed. I will tell you that it will be a substantial cost to crime laboratories to do that analysis over what's being done today.
Any questions? Representative Olin.
Yeah, and this isn't a negative plus or minus, but based on his testimony, I can guarantee in public safety finance, which you're now in, we have a $66 million deficit we're already being asked for to take care of. So I don't really think we're going to find any more money.
Representative Chairman,
the bill of gifts is going to, I hope it's going to public safety, and perhaps we can work on the definition and work and see if there's some way we can put some clause, you know, some clause in it so that it wouldn't take effect until you had done the full, until you had done the full legalization.
Thank you. Representative Dostoevsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this question is for either Representative Kahn or the BCA guy. I didn't catch your name. I'm sorry. If this were adopted into law and we were looking at, I think it was postured that you could have difficulty separating one from another without testing it. If you had a marijuana sample that was over, or at least at one point was over 0.3% of THC, as it dries, do those concentrations change as it dries, as it ages? Can you tell us a little bit about the dynamics of THC content in those that may have been above that level at one point?
Madam Chair, Representative, if you're doing these by weight and as it dries, the concentration would probably be different than it would be for a wet weight. Most of the samples that you're getting in law enforcement aren't wet. They're dry. They're usually look like oregano or lethal material. And at that point, you can't tell whether it came from a 10-foot industrial hemp plant or if it came from a 2-foot high-grade plant that's been growing particularly for its THC. The only way we'll be able to know that is to test it. And that quantitation will be, for labs, a very expensive step in identifying marijuana. A lot of it today isn't even sent to the laboratories. They're able to do field tests just to show that that they are marijuana, and so we don't even get involved with a large majority of those samples. Under this, we probably would get involved with almost all of them and have to do this type of analysis. Again, this isn't, I'm not saying that this is a bad thing or a good thing. This is just a consequence of changing the definition and of what that makes occur.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. I'll renew my motion in a moment. I would just remind members, maybe this is my weekly reminder, that we're the Ag Policy Committee, and I'm sure that public safety finance will talk about the finance part, and that public safety policy will talk about the public policy issues that are being raised here. But the testifier we had from Farmers Union certainly did.
Let me just say, for the record, the only reason I made it, brought that even up today, is to make sure that Representative Kahn was fully aware that these type of questions are going to show up. If he doesn't walk in there, not ready.
I anticipate Representative Olin that Representative Kahn, having had this bill a number of times, is fully prepared for the questions may come up, and members, unless someone signals me otherwise, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 608 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Any other questions? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members.
We're adjourned.